All right, now that I've done all that, we're going to turn now and welcome Dr. Robin Youngson to the studio. Good morning.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for inviting me back again. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Now, you've got a book launch tomorrow evening.
Tomorrow, yeah.
7 o'clock at Sunset Motel.
Yeah, in the conference room. That's it.
The book's called Science of Miracles, and you gave me a copy, so I've read it.
Yeah.
And I have many questions. Shall we say, what's the right background here? Before we do the backgrounds, you've had a long career in medicine. Before that, a brief career as an engineer. Your career seems to have gone from conventional to less and less conventional or more unusual as time has gone on.
That would be true to say. I no longer have a medical practicing certificate. I have an honorary title as doctor, but I no longer a practicing doctor.
Okay. Yeah. We get to call you that anyway, though,
because that's
how it works.
Yeah.
So the new book is called, I guess a little provocatively, Science of Miracles, The Science of Miracles.
Yeah.
And now I've read it, and it's not a how-to or a how-does-that-work book. There's much more to it. How do you describe it? Because there's like stories about you in there as well.
Yeah, so primarily it's a medical memoir. I see it as the culmination of my life's work.
Yeah.
It's a story of my many decades of efforts to make healthcare better, to make it more effective, more compassionate, more humane, to make patient care safer, and where that's led me. But with a background of engineering, which allows me to understand really well how systems and structures work, and I've used that kind of knowledge throughout my career. But ultimately, to fulfill my deepest identity and desire and purpose, which is to be a healer, and to work as a trauma therapist here in my Haven and Clinic here in Raglan, helping many people in this town and around the world. And that's not something you can ever be in the medical system. The word healer is even a dirty word. That means you're disreputable, you're alternative, you're a quack.
Oh, right, okay.
You're woo-woo. So
if you want to upset a doctor, call them a healer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which sounds crazy, right? That sentence sounds nuts.
Yeah.
To someone outside the system, outside the healthcare system, how do we talk about that?
My book is, I first wrote the book as a nonfiction book to make a series of arguments about how the medical system has become misguided, about how human beings are nothing like what medical science says. There's far more to us. We're mind, body, spiritual beings. We have extraordinary healing powers, which are completely negated by the medical system. But I knew from our experience of many years right around the world campaigning on compassionate healthcare that if you're trying to change people's deep-seated beliefs, arguments just create resistance, and persuasion doesn't work. So I first wrote a non-fiction book with a series of arguments and references and thought, no, that's not right, and then rewrote it again and then sent the manuscript to a high-powered editor to say, what do you think? And she said, well, if you wrote it as a medical memoir, it could work. So I thought, yeah, that's it. So the book doesn't put forward a single argument. It just shares my life journey, my experience, the extraordinary things I've seen, a radically different world of the view that I have, the view of the world that I have. And it's written as dramatized nonfiction. So the first chapter is like a medical thriller. I mean, you're from page one, you're right into the drama.
It's
a very compelling book.
Yeah,
my reviews say.
I'm just going to rearrange that slightly. You just stay where you are. All right. Sorry, folks. Just reorganizing the microphone as I do about every second interview, halfway through the interview. So it starts off with a traumatic scene in a hospital with a woman about to give birth.
Yes.
And you're pretty young at that point.
Yeah, I'm working in a very corrupt and broken medical system in the UK. I'm on a 48-hour shift. I've been practicing anesthesia for about 2 years or less, and I've been expected to do very high-risk emergency cases at night in pregnant women, you know, a very high-risk scenario, without the normal support that a consultant anaesthetist would demand during the day. So anaesthetists have like a co-pilot, which is an anaesthetic technician, which is essential for safe care. But there were no anaesthetic technicians available at night time. So the most junior, inexperienced anaesthetists, trainees, unsupervised, in the middle of the night, were doing extremely high-risk cases without that support at all. And there were two of my patients nearly died. I mean, it just absolutely terrified me.
Yeah, I mean, the story kind of turned out well in the sense that no one died.
Yeah.
But then you went on to try to confront that problem, didn't you?
Yeah. So as a result of some of my childhood experiences and particularly traumatic times in boarding school, I kind of innately knew how profoundly cruel institutions can be. And I knew about bullies, and I knew about suffering. And unknown to me, I didn't recognize it until I was in my 50s, is that from the moment I started at medical school, I had this extraordinary degree of empathy for the suffering of patients, far more than my colleagues. I'd never understood that. And it wasn't until much later in life that I suddenly realized that in every suffering patient in the hospital, I was subconsciously seeing myself as the 10 or 11-year-old boy in that suffering in this dreadful institution, which is an English boarding school.
But you can't have been the only doctor who went to an English boarding school.
No, probably not. But I entered medicine late, and after, you know, a traumatic childhood, kind of reinvented myself first as an intellectual and then as a kind of heroic explorer, and had many extraordinary adventures around the world, some of which are in the book. And that gave me a kind of courage and a strength and a broad perspective, and allowed me to have the courage to confront authorities in the medical system where everyone else had fallen into a kind of state of helplessness.
Now, in the movies, that character is celebrated and wins the day, you know, against odds and great odds and things like that. But how did it work out for you?
So, in the UK, I pretty much ruined my career. I came up against an implacable system. I challenged the chairman of the department, who was an extremely powerful man. It was a very hierarchical system. And he made it very clear that these were my problems, that I was incompetent, that I was only having these difficulties because I wasn't good enough. No one else in the room would speak up, so I was utterly alone. And
so this is your colleagues who are at the same level as you, just a little bit of experience.
Yeah, they had the exact same experiences, and they all kept quiet and, you know, no eye contact, staring at the floor. I mean, as a trauma therapist, I now recognize that reaction. That's the freeze reaction. Mm. That's a traumatic reaction. And then the Royal College of Anaesthetists came to do a visit to our hospital to make sure it's an okay and safe place for trainees, an accreditation visit. And they seemed to be genuinely interested and concerned, and they wanted to hear my stories and promised it was confidential and were horrified by what I'd said. So I thought, well, something will be done. But then nothing happened, and then I discovered that the Royal College of Anaesthetists had three people on the kind of board of directors were from my hospital. And so the word went out, no, Robin, he's just a troublemaker. He's incompetent. He's blaming everyone else. And then to cap it all, I had a six-month visit to New Zealand and discovered radically different safety standards here, including the use of instruments like pulse oximeters and gas monitoring that make anaesthesia dramatically safer. And they'd been mandatory standards here for at least 5 years. And I went back to the UK, and I'm working in a major teaching hospital, and I'm giving an anaesthetic without even a pulse oximeter to measure the oxygen level in a patient. I mean, the most critical measure you can have. So I wrote an article for New Scientist magazine introducing this new technology.
Just to make sure you really ruined your career.
Yeah. And how this technology could make anaesthesia so much safer, and just showing, you know, saying I was just outraged that in the UK – still hadn't introduced this technology that had been in use for many years. And that I wrote a title something like, you know, New Monitoring Makes Anaesthesia Safer. But the editor of the journal thought that was a rather boring title, so he changed it to Why Anaesthesia Can Still Kill. So that was the article that appeared under my name. So then that was it. I was blacklisted in the UK. I mean, I just knew that it would be completely impossible for me to get a job there or progress my career. So luckily, I'm married to a Kiwi.
You had an escape.
And I had a job offer here. But, you know, I was a pariah. Even on my learning, on my leaving due, I said, come and join me at the pub for some drinks and have a bit of a leaving party. Not one of my medical colleagues came. I mean, I just became a pariah.
Right,
it was too dangerous for other people to associate with me.
Yeah.
So So that's kind of the beginning.
That's a demoralizing story, really.
Yeah.
And to listen to those other people not do that.
But it made me ever more determined to take on the system, and that's what I've done for about 35 years at many different levels.
Now, with lots more experience at that, how do you think young you should have handled that situation, or were you too young to actually do anything, or, you know, too powerless in the hierarchical system?
I mean, I think looking back, my strategy was ineffective for creating change.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back from the perspective of a trauma therapist, I can see that the chairman of the department who behaved so badly was a very traumatized individual.
Mm.
You know, just completely wrapped up in his status and his wealth and his private practice and his power.
And you were threatening that.
And these are all the traits of someone who's, you know, really quite damaged and traumatized. And in the end, the only way we make the system better is to bring back compassion into the system and start healing. Because, I mean, we know a third or a half of all doctors are burnt out, which means emotional exhaustion and depersonalization and cynicism and feeling like your work doesn't matter anymore. I mean, we have a highly traumatized, highly damaged system, and the only way to mend it is to actually start taking care of people.
Have you ever had any contact? Because later on you came and you helped set up a hospital
in
Waitemata,
Waitakere Hospital. Yeah,
Waitakere Hospital. Yeah, so did anyone from the UK who knew you then become aware of you over here having that? I mean, that's a high status thing, which the last thing they would have expected.
Maybe. I mean, some of our work at Waitakere Hospital, I mean, I had two editorials published in major international medical journals. But, I mean, at Waitakere Hospital, I worked with an absolutely brilliant general manager, Rachel Haggerty, and a director of nursing. She was the first ever Māori nurse in the hospital 30 years before, and she became director of nursing, Kay Hogan, and a wonderful HR manager. And we were very values-based, principled, courageous leaders, and we did actually create a really compassionate and caring and safe environment at Waitakere Hospital. But then we had the opportunity to build an entirely new hospital and recruit hundreds of staff and kind of bring them into a different kind of a culture.
Start with a clean sheet.
And we achieved many things. And, you know, if any visitor to the hospital, from the moment they stepped in the front door, would sense that the culture of this place is different. They're met by a smiling human being. They're welcomed in. You know, it feels safer. We pretty much eliminated bullying between the staff, which is endemic in healthcare institutions. And we pursued that for many years, and we had great ambitions for Waitakere being a model compassionate hospital, you know, for the world, a center of compassionate healthcare. And then a new chief executive was appointed at the DHB and thought it was wrong for Waitakere Hospital to have its own leadership. So the leadership of Waitakere Hospital got merged into North Shore Hospital, and all of the inspirational leaders were either sacked or lost their jobs. So I was, you know, I was made redundant from my role.
Something I wanted to just briefly touch on is because you talked about in the UK, and then you came the standard of care for in the UK was behind what was happening in New Zealand in your area, anesthesiology. But were the same, it sounds like from that story, that the same attitudes about hierarchy and, I don't know, control and all those sort of things are still present in the New Zealand health system.
Yeah, that's, Meredith and I launched an international movement for compassionate healthcare called Hearts and Healthcare. And we traveled around the world for more than a decade, visiting many different countries and cultures. And what we discovered is that fundamental problems in healthcare are exactly the same in every system. I mean, in the USA, they assume that their healthcare system is broken because it's all about money. But I explained to them, well, we have the same rates of burnout of doctors in New Zealand as you do in America. It's not about the money. It's about the fundamental nature of medical science and the culture of the organizations and you know, the nature of how organizations work. That's the fundamental problem. And that's, you know, my book is an exploration over a lifetime of my own personal beliefs and a recognition of, you know, ultimately, what are the societal myths and beliefs about the nature of the world that underpin broken systems, not just in healthcare, but in education and housing, in our food system, and, you know, the climate crisis, So, you know, my book is, in a way, a kind of philosophical exploration over a lifetime of trying to really understand what is the deep causes of our problems.
I mean, the degree I studied at university, the school I was in, was rife with bullying.
Yeah.
And my solution was to make myself invisible, basically.
Yeah.
And there was one lecturer there who was trying to do things differently. And yeah. He was reviled by the rest of the staff. They mm-hmm. would call staff meetings and he would not be invited. He wouldn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I found out one day when I was walking. He and I were walking past the staff room and I saw all the rest of the staff in there. I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Oh, it's a staff meeting." And I said, "Why aren't you in there?" He said, "Oh, I wasn't told about it."
Yeah.
That's in the field of architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other people in different degrees talk about mm-hmm. similar experiences. So this is not just a medical thing, or healthcare industry mm-hmm. problem, is it?
No, not at all. That's really, I mean, and you know, the last couple of chapters in my book are really a philosophical exploration of, you know, what is the nature of our modern society and what are the fundamental myths and beliefs that sit behind that? How do we perceive the world? How do we try to solve problems? And how could we frame that in a radically different way that actually gives us much more hope?
So what is it, a thing that severely traumatized people gravitate toward those positions of power?
It's really complex. I mean, maybe I can illustrate it with an example. So in our work on compassionate healthcare, we did want to make, you know, we shared lots of amazing stories that touched people's hearts and made them cry and reminded them why they came into healthcare as a nurse or a doctor or a therapist or a midwife. So we touched people's hearts, but we also uncovered a lot of scientific research showing that if care is compassionate, patients do much better. Like if you're going to hospital for an operation and if you measure the healing of a surgical wound day by day with a microscope, if the patient receives compassionate care, the wound actually heals more quickly. Even if you're the victim of major trauma and you're rushed into the hospital with major life-threatening injuries, you would think it's the skill of the trauma surgeon that would determine your survival and your outcomes. Mm. Even in that field, it's shown, there was a big study showed that if patients rated their trauma surgeon as a compassionate individual, they were like three times more likely to be in the best outcome group 8 weeks after their injury in terms of functional recovery. And we uncovered so much evidence that compassionate care, it gets much better patient outcomes. It gives joy and satisfaction to the work of health professionals. It dramatically reduces patient demand and patients get better quickly. So it actually saves a huge amount of money.
Mm.
So it's a win-win-win for the patients, for the health professionals, and for the funders. And it should spread like wildfire as the number one organizational strategy for, you know, saving money, let alone caring for patients better. And we've campaigned and worked in dozens of organizations and we presented this evidence and we've done workshops with staff and they were highly enthusiastic about it. And it's never been sustained in any organization except for one medical school in the USA that became a compassionate medical school. So there's something about the system, there's something about our fundamental beliefs about the world that prevents us from even implementing proven solutions.
And what is that thing?
And that thing is, it has taken me a lifetime to understand. And I can give the example from medicine and then kind of widen it out to the rest of the world. If you look at the nature of medical science and how it changed more than a century ago, in 1910, there was a report in the USA and Canada about the future of medical education. And that report said that medical science needs to be a very rigorous science. And the only form of science that is reliable is a randomized controlled trial. And they closed down all of the medical schools that had a kind of humanistic approach. And they got two industrialists of the time, Rockefeller and Carnegie, who were the billionaires of the time, gave massive research grants to the prestigious medical schools that then became research institutions, not teaching institutions. So the report said medical schools can't survive as a training school. They have to be research institutions. And therefore, they became dependent on the research funding. And they incorporated a very narrow materialistic version of science from Europe into medical training, which basically assumes that the human body is a machine and is not conscious. And if something is a machine, you can take it down into its component parts and fix a part and fix the whole machine. And that's the fundamental basis of medical science. It's completely dehumanized, depersonalized. And the gold standard for medical evidence, for what we call evidence-based practice, is the placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial. That's a form of research that completely removes any effect of human consciousness on the outcome. Because when you do a trial of a new drug, you find that people who get the placebo drug, the fake drug, a lot of them actually get better all by themselves. Mm. They've had no active drug. So human beings have this capacity for healing. But this was an annoying interference in the research trial. Yeah. So they had to figure out a way to eliminate that effect to prove that the treatment actually worked. So that's what a placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial is to exclude all effects of human consciousness, of belief, of thoughts, of feelings, and just assume that the treatment is the basis of a chemical reaction and, you know, working in the human machine. And that is the entire basis of evidence-based practice. So doctors who say that complementary or alternative therapy is, you know, not evidence-based, not scientific, you know, they're basically dismissing that completely. So that's
But it's not evidence-based because no one went and made some evidence according to that standard.
Yeah, but it's, you know, so we have evidence-based treatment. We don't have evidence-based medicine. Now, what I know from my more recent work is that human beings have extraordinary powers of healing. And but that requires a very different set of conditions and a very different relationship between the practitioner and the person you're trying to serve. And it's an impossible within the medical setting because medical science says it's impossible. And the power relationship between doctors and patients, which is so dominant and controlling, interferes and suppresses the healing process. And so the work that I do is completely invisible to the medical profession. I mean, it can't exist.
It can't measure it, can it?
Well, I mean, we can measure it, but not
according to that.
Not according to a placebo-controlled trial.
But you can't measure the effect of consciousness and human interaction on the medicine by using a system that is designed to exclude that stuff
absolutely.
Specifically. Yeah.
So medical science is a materialistic science which is designed to exclude any aspect of human consciousness or thoughts and feelings. And yet we know, for instance, that if you have early life trauma, that changes all of your gene expression. It changes all of your hormonal environment. It creates inescapable physiological stress. It rewires your brain. And that means you're 4 times more likely to get endometriosis, 3 times more likely to get cardiovascular disease or cancer or autoimmune disease, or to become an alcoholic or a smoker or get lung disease. And, you know, but all these effects are excluded. I mean, these are more important when I go to the GP for a cardiovascular risk assessment. He only measures my blood pressure, my cholesterol and my weight and, you know, whether I'm a smoker or not.
The mechanics.
It doesn't look at any of whether I'm a, you know, a happy, contented, secure individual, whether I've had a good life, whether it doesn't look at my lifestyle. I mean, it's a chemical equation with numbers.
Has the doctor got time for that?
No, because we have a system that's designed to exclude the time for that. It's why a doctor's appointment is 10 or 15 minutes, right? The system is designed to maintain itself.
Well, yeah, and
where the end result is a drug prescription, and not actually delving into the root causes of illness.
And no system would exist if it wasn't self-reinforcing,
because
it would immediately fall apart.
Yeah.
So it is going to be that way, and you've obviously wanted to change it. And it obviously doesn't want to change, and so you kind of got like forced to the fringes by that system.
In the end, it was just so painful for me to work with a mainstream system when I saw so many people being hurt.
Yeah.
And treatments that were not helpful and sometimes harm people. And when I knew so much better was possible, you know, it just, because I'd become aware within myself that my deeper purpose was to be a healer, to do much deeper work.
Yeah,
and the conflict between, you know, the part of my personality that was the expert doctor that invested 14 years of training and gaining that, you know, power and status and knowledge and skills, the conflict between that and the part of me that desperately wanted to be a healer. I mean, in the end, caused a physical illness for me. I mean, it's an illustration of kind of mind-body connections.
Do you think that conflict's going on inside a lot of our medical professionals?
Yeah, I'm absolutely certain that the majority of people who enter into healthcare do so because they want to care. I mean, many of them have their own experiences of suffering. They're the wounded healers, right?
Yeah.
That they have profound empathy and compassion because they have a knowing of suffering and they want to address it. And they go into a system that is just so brutalizing and inhumane that their hearts are crushed. And I mean, even there was research in the UK about 20 years ago showing that new nurse graduates graduated with high ideals of patient-centered care, and within 2 years their ideals were crushed and many were job hopping or leaving the profession within 2 years in the NHS in the UK.
Right.
So this has been well known for a long time.
So one of the things you've done is you've held, I want to use the word camps, but it's the wrong word, for medical professionals to come and for you to provide an environment of support, at least for a weekend or something like that?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, so I'm getting the details wrong, but yeah. You can describe it, hopefully.
Yeah. So in my work as a trauma therapist using havening techniques, one of the things we offer is to look after one human being for 5 days and to invite them into our home and to have Meredith's beautiful food and hosting, to stay in our apartment, to have healing work done every day, time in nature, just to wrap around some trauma healing and care and try and change the trajectory of someone's life, you know, and help them heal and recover from trauma. And a number of senior doctors have come for that. But I also run training courses in havening techniques. But unlike most of my colleagues, I don't regard this just as a training course, which is in the beginning just the standard course is just a 2-day very compressed course, a very rushed way of teaching you science and techniques. I realized that about half of the participants coming to my training courses were really pretty traumatized individuals. These are mental health professionals. They're counselors, psychologists, therapists, some doctors who have this empathy and compassion, but they're burnt out, they're traumatized, they're struggling. And I realized that the greater need was actually to support their healing, and we do that in a group process. So they learn the havening techniques by doing real work with each other, but the primary aim is creating a therapeutic community for 5 days and people healing together, and that's what we run here in Raglan.
So we've mentioned havening quite a bit now. Yes. For those who are wondering, what is that?
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah, so havening techniques is what we call a psychosensory technique. So it's a technique for rapidly healing trauma. It's developed by a medical doctor in the USA, Dr. Ronald Rudin, who's an internal medicine specialist and PhD researcher. And he became intensely curious about what happens in the brain when we get traumatized. When we go through a very traumatic event, how can that lead to a lifelong fear and anxiety and depression and phobias? Something has changed in the brain. Something has been recorded in the brain to account for that. And he became very curious about how that works. And in 2019, he published a very detailed scientific paper showing exactly how traumatic events are stored in the brain and a part of the brain called the amygdala, all the way down to the molecular reactions that occur at the cellular level. He described that in detail. In the course of that research, he discovered that chemical mechanism, that chemical reaction that stores the trauma in the nerve cells can actually be set in reverse.
Yeah.
And that reverse reaction occurs in only about 5 to 10 minutes. It's a very fast reaction. And he further discovered that this chemical reaction to erase a traumatic memory can be stimulated with very specific forms of touch, soothing touch. Now, you notice when people are nervous, they rub their hands together like this or rub their hands on their legs. Mm. When we see someone distressed and crying, we rub them on the upper arm and the shoulder. When we're overwhelmed, we touch and rub our faces. So he discovered through neuroscience that these forms of touch are detected by newly discovered nerve types in the skin that detect a soothing touch, and that these signals go to the brain and change the brain waves and create this chemical reaction that dissolves away a trauma. So someone might come to my clinic with 10 years of severe anxiety, depression, social phobia, fear of men after a traumatic rape, a violent rape. And in 15 or 20 minutes, we can completely erase any traces of this trauma from the from this person's brain doesn't take away the objective memory. So then the anxiety, the depression, the fear, the triggers, they're just erased. They're just gone. It is the most astounding thing to witness. And that's the nature of the work that I do. It has hugely profound implications, not only for mental health, but for physical health as well.
So do they have to tell you about the trauma?
So no, this is one of the, it's a very compassionate therapy. So if someone does want to speak of a trauma, which might be re-traumatizing for them, I don't need to know a single word of what the story is, so long as they can take themselves back to the most distressing moment of that event when they felt most powerless and distressed and hold that in their mind very briefly for 30 or 60 seconds and to give me a score out of 10 for how distressing that was at the time it was happening. That's all they need to do.
So that little bit of wiring in the brain when the memory is stored, that needs to be activated.
Correct. While you're so going back, consciously recalling a memory will activate the nerve cells that are holding that trauma.
Yeah.
And then we can do the work on them. We can catalyze this chemical reaction.
I imagine that could be a point where people are like, oh, I don't really want to feel that again. That might be, if they don't have the emotion, that might slow them up in achieving anything there.
It doesn't, because we never lose the gifts. I mean, you know, I can look at my own experience. I've had many traumatic experiences. I still have the knowledge of them. It doesn't reduce my motivation to try and address those things.
Yeah.
But now I do so with much greater wisdom and from a place of equanimity and grounded, rather than acting out of my anger or my shame or my, you know, rage or frustration or hurt. Because
yeah.
We're never effective in our leadership when we're acting out of a, you know, we actually need to, we need to find that place of standing still with the full knowledge of those events and to be wise in our strategies. And that's what happens when we heal. And many, I think about 50 of my clients have gone on to do the Havening training. It's been so astounding in their lives, and they're just motivated to try and help other people. Yeah. The best therapists are those who've been through their own major trauma, they've healed it, and then they bring forward the gifts of empathy and compassion and understanding and non-judgment, and they have profound faith in the capacity of people to heal because they've seen it in their own lives. So, they make better therapists than the psychologists or the counselors or the doctors who are, you know, still a bit stuck in their intellectual frameworks.
Yeah, I know some. There's a counselor I talk to regularly, and when she did her counseling, at that particular school, they had to be counseled themselves.
Yeah.
For that specific reason, that they had to have had that experience, and also it would stop them from, they might not want to go to a certain area or discuss a certain thing. So, that's, what is it that, I mean, it feels like that should be the way it is.
Yes.
For someone outside the system, anyone involved in anything like that should have some experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no.
And I mean, a hospital should be a place that's profoundly healing for all those who work within it.
So, have you felt the need or people in the Havening community to produce a double blind placebo study? And is it even possible, as we were discussing earlier?
Sure. So, it's extraordinarily difficult to get research done in this field because, as you said, the system defends itself against knowledge that would, you know, start to crumble the underpinnings of the system.
Yeah.
So I tried for a number of years and talked to a number of researchers in different universities, and I'd even done a pilot trial with extraordinary results in mothers with childbirth trauma. And it's extraordinarily difficult to find a researcher, academic researcher, willing to risk their reputation on what's, you know, not scientific woo-woo. One of the people I trained, a senior psychiatrist, applied to a hospital ethical committee for ethical committee approval to do a pilot trial, not even with patients, just with staff. And the ethical committee turned them down and said, it's not ethical to try an unproven intervention in a vulnerable population. I mean, this is pure catch-22.
That's my first thought.
And then, and if you overcome those hurdles, you can't get research funding because the people who sit on committees that decide research funding are stuck in the biomedical model, right? And they're not going to fund. And even if you can overcome all those hurdles and do a randomized trial and you try to get it published and you can't get it published because the peer reviewers will reject it because it's too foreign to their beliefs. The results are too good to be true. So an academic research group in the UK with Haveners and academics did do a controlled trial, and how they got a group of people, more than 100, and they split them into two randomly.
Yeah.
And two of them remained on the wait list. You know, half of them remained on the wait list, and half of them went ahead and had one episode of Havening. And they used a standardized outcome measure, and they showed extraordinary results. And it took them 3 years to get it published. And by the time it was published, the paper was so mangled by the peer reviewers that it, you know, almost doesn't say anything. They've gone on and they've done a second paper, which they've done much better. But those, so there are two randomized control trials. In the second paper, they used a measure of resilience and showed that after one session of Havening techniques, people's resilience from a point from a very low resilience score that you would kind of see with PTSD to almost back to normal for popular healthy population, very extraordinary results. So that was published last year. So there's a beginning of research evidence, but it's extraordinarily difficult.
I guess that's how it goes. You've managed to squeeze one distorted thing through the system,
yeah,
and that slightly opens the door wider for the next one.
Sure.
But it's slow.
Yeah, it's a bit slower than you might imagine. So academics have actually researched how quickly does innovation spread in medicine.
Oh, yeah.
So they showed that, let's say we invent a new treatment for heart attacks that would reduce mortality by 50%, so really significant.
Mm.
And you've proven it in five large randomized control trials. So the research evidence is absolutely solid. You know, you've in thousands of patients. On average, the time it takes for proven new science to be routinely adopted in medical practice is 17 years. So for us to accumulate the research evidence for Havening would take us 10 years, and then we'd wait, you know, another maybe 15 years. So, you know, we're talking about a quarter of a century to actually shift. And the world's in crisis, and we have a mental health crisis, and we've got to do something a bit quicker than that. So I've actually abandoned all attempts to try and get research done within the mainstream system. I think there are better strategies.
Mm. And your strategy is obviously building something outside of the system. And
yeah,
if you've trained, yeah, 50 other Haveners, yeah, up, then obviously that is what's happening.
Yeah, and a number of them are working within the mainstream system. They're established counselors and therapists and psychologists. Some of them working, okay, for ACC, who are quietly using Havening without saying very much about what they're doing. They might be calling it counselling or psychology.
Right, yeah,
and
okay.
Getting, you know, great results.
So a lot of counsellors and therapists have to kind of, it's another string to their bow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And it may,
yeah,
become their major,
yeah,
string.
And there's quite a high demand for my training courses. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think we can, you know, the whole health research field is completely dominated by the professionals. And I think there's a way we can democratize health research. And I became aware of a group in Vancouver of data scientists and researchers who developed an app called Quantified Citizen.
Mm.
And this is intended to study very large populations of people and show changes in mental health outcomes with different interventions. They have the world's biggest trial of microdosing of psychedelics, mm, more than 20,000 people enrolled. And the app does not capture any of your identifiable details at all. It has no name, no email address, no phone number. You're given a kind of random code. So all the data is completely anonymous and it's safe. But the app does a whole pile of standardized mental health interventions. So you do a whole pile of questionnaires before, as you start. You provide it with demographic information, and then it prompts you for information about your mood, your level of function, how you're feeling. If you've got a Fitbit or an Apple Watch, it's measuring your stress responses. Mm. It's gathering all that data, and it's correlating it with the interventions. So I think if we did that for Havening, you know, we could, every person using the app interfaces with it every day, and they could say whether or not they had a Havening, whether they did some Havening for themselves or had a session, and you can gather data on tens of thousands of people, and then a data scientist can correlate the interventions to the outcomes. So it's a way of democratizing health research because we're actually measuring the real life outcomes that matter to people.
So does the established system of measuring effectiveness of science and medicine, what do they think about that? Or do you just not care what they think because this has been built outside the system?
I'm not even going to ask. I mean, it's
I think you know the answer.
Yeah. So, you know, my strategy, I mean, I did about a year ago, I launched a crowd fund, and I said, look, we can do this for $28,000. And we in 30 days, we got up to 50% of the funds, and it was an all or nothing campaign. So we didn't succeed, but there was a lot of interest. Mm. And I think, you know, if we tried again, we'd probably succeed. And we just need to build our own system of research. And I think there are ways in which we can actually teach people how to take care of, you know, mental health working together. That in the modern world, there's so much emphasis on kind of trying to take care of yourself, doing, you know, learn mindfulness or do self-havening or do all these things just by yourself. But I believe that people heal in relationship. And I think we can very quickly and easily train ordinary people, you know, in a weekend workshop to do some really wonderful things with their family and their friends and their peers, and to measure outcomes and to build a parallel mental health system, because our mainstream mental health system is in deep crisis and is failing.
It's in a terrible state. What time do you have to leave?
Okay, I'm fine until,
I've got someone else coming in at 9:30, but there was
I'm fine till 9:30.
Okay,
yeah.
There's something I specifically wanted to ask about. Wait, by the way, folks have just tuned in, talking to Dr. Robin Youngson. He's got a book launch tomorrow, 7 o'clock in the evening at Sunset Motel. The book's called The Science of Miracles. And there's a story in there about dealing with the midwives and the doctors. This is Waitakere Hospital.
Waitakere Hospital, yes.
Yeah, so when we went to have children, we had a home birth midwife, and we were told about, you know, you have a birth plan, and if you end up in the hospital, the system there might want to do things differently to your birth plan. And so my role is the father who wasn't the one giving birth was to a little bit try to guard that process.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a young guy there, so I was up for the battle. But luckily, we didn't have to go through any of that. But that my experience where the midwives versus the system in the hospital, that's pretty universal, isn't it, around the country?
Yeah.
And not all midwives, I guess, because there's different flavors of midwifery, I guess you could say. But at Waitakere, this was a problem?
Yeah. So around the world, there's extremely serious concern about the rising rate of cesarean sections, which in some countries is up to 50% of all births. You know, in New Zealand, it's running 25-30%, depends on where you are. The WHO says that, you know, if we actually did this at the optimal rate, it might be 12 or 15% of births, where a cesarean section would be justified both for mother and baby. So we're doing a very large number of major operations in people that are potentially dangerous, and rates of maternal mortality are actually increasing slowly over time.
Despite this.
It gets dangerous to do repeated cesarean sections,
because it's
a major surgery, right? Yeah. One cesarean is extremely safe. Two cesareans is safe. Three starts to get a bit riskier. I mean, it's just complications ensue. So midwives are fully independent health professionals. They have their own college. They have their own training. They have a view of childbirth as a natural process, as it is.
Not as an emergency.
As a medicalized, you know, procedure. And there are many, you know, emotional and social and spiritual components to childbirth and its meaning and its success. And I have a great deal of sympathy for the midwife's view. And the research evidence would back up their claims that we're doing far too many medical interventions. And on the other side, I've worked a lot in maternity as an anaesthetist. The anaesthetists and the obstetricians, the only childbirth they get to see is the emergency when it goes wrong.
Yeah.
And too often we're confronted at 2 o'clock in the morning with a severe emergency where the labor is obstructed, the baby is stuck, the baby is now in danger of its life, the baby's heart rate has fallen down really low. If we can't get this baby delivered within a few minutes, it's going to die.
Yeah.
And we've never met this mother before, and we're trying to provide very dangerous medical care in suboptimal conditions when there's been no communication, no preparation. So there ended up an enormous amount of anger and distrust between midwives and doctors. And because the only response of the doctors, you know, rushing to the delivery room was to do an immediate cesarean section because it's now a dire emergency, the midwives formed a belief that that's the only thing that doctors want to do. They just love operating.
And
the doctors formed a belief that the mothers care nothing about the mother's safety. The midwives care nothing about the mother's safety because they keep putting them into these dreadful situations, when in fact what they're trying to do is protect the natural childbirth and keep the doctor out of the room. And so there was this very powerful dynamic set up with increasing anger and distrust, and three babies had died, and both a midwife and an obstetrician were having competency reviews. A lot of people were resigning, the on-call rosters were collapsing, and we were in danger of losing the entire maternity unit. Mm. And the traditional approach to try to reduce cesarean section rates is to write clinical guidelines and to pretend that people make rational decisions. But actually, people are acting out of their fears in these tense situations, not rationally. So I knew that the only way to resolve this situation was to design a process in which the doctors and the midwives and the mums and all the parties should be allowed to expose their beliefs, their assumptions, their motivations, and to be able to learn to communicate together again. And we started with sociodrama and role play, which was terribly threatening to all the parties. and we began the role play using chairs to represent people. And then that led to a dialogue forum monthly where we gradually build trust and relationships and collaboration. And so now a midwife would call a doctor early into the room and introduce a mum and say what's happening and work as a team rather than just call them for an emergency. And over the next 2 years, the cesarean section rate in the whole hospital fell by 30%. No other maternity unit in Australia and New Zealand has achieved that. The number of babies born in a poor condition at birth went from 6% of births to 1% of births. The number of patient complaints fell by a factor of 3. It's the most striking improvement in clinical outcomes in a maternity service that I've ever seen documented. It was published in an international journal as an editorial. And so this is the nature. You know, hospitals are a seething mass of, you know, communication and beliefs and stories and miscommunication and feelings, and you know that's actually how a hospital works. It's not rational, but managers assume a hospital is a machine, and the same way the doctors assume the human being is a machine. Yeah. So there's a kind of, you know, command and control structure, but that's not what actually hospitals are made of. And if we actually work with what hospitals are actually made of, then we can make dramatic improvements. But that work has never been replicated.
I was interested in that story because we're living at a time now where people are very, and any issue for debate comes up, people immediately go to the opposite sides of the room.
Yeah.
And you sat in a room like that where they were sitting,
yeah.
I don't know, if maybe literally on opposite sides of the room, yeah. like in their respective... Yeah.
Eyeball to eyeball.
Yeah, right. And so, you tell the story kind of quickly because it happened over, really happened over months. But, I mean, how did... They didn't want to talk to start with to each other.
No, they were extremely angry. I mean, yeah. I volunteered to chair this forum, knowing that I didn't have the skills to facilitate a process where there was so much anger and distrust, and had a very skilled facilitator sitting beside me, coaching me in real time in front of the whole group, so that every time it went off the rails, he'd say, "Hey, Robin, I noticed this is happening. Do you want to sit down?" And he'd check something out and say, "Robin, if you try it this way, it might work better. Try again." I'd be sweating. I'd be embarrassed.
You're in a very vulnerable situation. Yeah. You're trying to lead it, and all your mistakes are on show.
But that was my superpower, because I knew if I made myself vulnerable, it would give permission for other people to be vulnerable.
Mm.
Whereas if I retained authority, everyone's going to just be defensive. So it was a deliberate strategy. It was painful.
ultimately successful.
It was transformative. Yeah, and when I left that maternity unit 10 years later, all the same people were still there. And, 40 of them came to my farewell dinner.
As opposed to when you left the UK. No one came.
Because there was such a sense of community and trust and shared care.
Do you think those people have gone out to other hospitals and tried to build... where they've ended up?
Well, I was actually asked by a coroner and the Health and Disability Commissioner to go down to the South Island to another major hospital where they had a huge upset, and it just became apparent that there wasn't the quality of courageous leadership necessary to hold and lead such a process. So it was futile.
Mm.
So you can't implement those kind of processes unless you have the leadership to keep people safe and contain the stresses for change.
Yeah.
And it does take courageous leadership.
And there's not necessarily a lot of that around. I would hazard a
no,
guess.
No, because most people are brutalized and dehumanized and burnt out and, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess you're not here telling us you've got the answers.
The end of my book is it's an invitation to think of things in very different ways. So, our whole world kind of assumes that the world is like a machine and we have an extractive economy and we don't see a forest as a living being that creates oxygen for us to survive. We see it as a source of lumber, of timber, of resources. So we mine, we extract. So that's our worldview. But what I've learned through my healing work is that there's a totally different view, which is to see things as a living being. So if I see a human being as a living conscious being, then I can tap into extraordinary powers of healing. And the same is true of nature. Nature has extraordinary powers of regeneration and healing if we just leave it alone, stop poisoning it. And it's a radically different way of thinking about the world. So I talk about that. And we just have to start to create new institutions that are based on radically different values. So I share a vision of what a truly healing hospital would look like. And that's in the last page or two of my book. And I was pleased the other day, there's a major website and organization in America called Mad in America. They're really trying to challenge the existing psychiatric system and put in place a radically different and they were pleased to publish. I co-wrote a vision with a young Maori doctor, a bicultural vision of a healing hospital, and they were pleased to publish our vision, our article of a truly healing hospital just last week. One day someone will come up to us with $10 million and say, look, I'm inspired, just do it. And we've already trained all the people that could be the most wonderful carers.
So that's the way you do it.
And then, because it's futile trying to change the existing system. It's dying and it has to die. It needs palliative
care. My question is do we have to have a monster crisis before things change?
We're already in a monster crisis, right?
I guess so. I guess for the people who've gone into the mental health care system and been spat out in the same or worse state, that is the monster crisis already for their life.
This is the nature of change, isn't it? There's the great unraveling. I mean, it's a lot of people just trying to get on with life, as normal, and some people that are starting to generate a new vision, and these three processes are happening. Simultaneously.
So we're talking to Dr. Robin Youngson. His book, The Science of Miracles, the launch in Raglan is happening tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. That's Tuesday night. And what are you doing at the launch?
So everyone's welcome. We ask people please to just sign up for a free ticket at Eventbrite so we can have it organized. We're going to have some free drinks and nibbles. My wife, Mary, is going to introduce me.
Yes.
My daughter, Chloe, who features some of her stories in the book, is hoping to send in a video message. She's in Canada at the moment. I'm going to explain a little bit about why I wrote the book and what the book is about. I will probably read some short excerpts. We have a documentary filmmaker because there's a group called Kiwis Doing Good, which has decided to make a short film documentary about my work, and they insisted on turning up at my book launch and filming that.
Of course.
So if there's anyone, I have havened a lot of people in this community. People's lives have been changed. If you're coming along for the book launch and you'd like to say a word or two to camera about the work we've done together, that would be great. But, if you don't want to, that's fine. So we're going to have a documentary filmmaker there, and we're going to have some wine and some nibbles, and I'm going to. You can get your book at a discount price and get it signed by the author, and we're just going to celebrate for a little while.
And one thing I should bring up too is you mentioned Meredith, your wife.
Yes,
she features throughout the book. She's not just by your side. I think she's. I get the feeling she's made what you've done. You've done a lot of remarkable things, but I don't think you could have done it without her.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The first reviewer said this is just a wonderful love story about Robin and Meredith. And a number of people commented, but it's extraordinary the leadership that Meredith has contributed. So it's our joint story. It's mostly mine, but she features pretty widely.
Yeah.
You get a sense of her.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. All right, Robin, thanks heaps for coming in this morning.
I
really enjoyed the chat, and I hope that other media are taking notice other than a little community station in your town.